You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Titled Craig and Fred. Just to let you know, your tease about the book caught my attention, but the photos of handsome Fred and learning that he was rescued sold the book. The Kindle edition is now on my iPad. I wish Craig and Fred many more years of companionship. Yeah, it's a cool story. And then here's the other one. It's entitled Barnum Reflects on the Life of Wesley Fox. I got an email back. Marines do not use umbrellas. Amen. I'm smiling. Keep attacking. Hoorah. It's awesome. Awesome stuff. So Barn Dollar is, I just got his phone number. So stand by. That's called on-air producing, just so you know. It's kind of unprofessional, but I never said I was professional, okay? I just, you know, if it doesn't work for you, you got to make it up while you go. All right, so you're going to heal. You're going to hear Gil Barndollar, Mos Skosh. And then at the top of the hour, from Iraq, yeah, Chris Julian's going to join it. So looking forward to that.
Hey, good morning.
Barndollar, you're live on the radio, so don't say anything that you don't want the world to know.
It's good to know.
Exactly. Yeah. See, that's a sign of a true professional. When he greets somebody, instead of like, hey, what's up, whatever would come next. You say, hey, bro, just so you know. Musselman failed to do that to me once with his daughter in the car on speaker.
Yeah. Well, I think I heard that one.
Yeah, that did not work out well. And, and he's had to pay the price for it. First of all,
you've got an open any rule in the third hour now, right?
you know what? Yeah, that he installed, and he's the only one abusing it. So, but you know what? That's how he is. The rules are, it's like sands in the hourglass. What was that soap opera? You know, the sand is always moving. That's how the gunner's rules are.
Yeah, I think it's before my time.
No, it wasn't. Trust me. You're not that young. All right. So, Gil, born and raised where?
Born in Vermont, raised in New Hampshire.
Went to college where?
Bowdoin.
That's right. The guy with the droopy mustache in the rear with the gear.
Home of heroes.
Exactly. Winds up on the far left flank because Strong Vince is trying to keep the little guy out of the way and winds up being the lion of Little Round Top, Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain.
I'm just saying there's a reason they gave him the surrender at Appomattox.
You know what? You're probably right about that. I have my own version of it. And so let's not get truth get in the way of my version of it. I'll tell you what, if you ever want to read an incredible little piece of American history, it's a book by a guy named Oliver Norton, who is the guidon bearer for Vincent's brigade And Chamberlain is a regimental commander in the brigade. And you'll get to read Norton's book on what happened at Little Round Top. And it's pretty cool little read, and the fighting was absolutely incredible. The first column goes over the top in a column of fours and goes down the hill in a column of fours deploying out of that with nothing in the tube because the Confederates are so close to the crest. The guy commanding that was a lieutenant by the name of Patrick O'Rourke out of West Point, and he dies that day as well. Vincent dies the following day as he bleeds to death when something nicked his femoral artery near his groin while directing combat operations at the top of the hill. And it's just an amazing fight. And, again, if those guys don't get there and Hood and McLaws turn the Union left flank at Gettysburg, good question if we're the same nation we are today. So, interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Barndollar is a descendant of that, so... Or at least he went to the same school that Chamberlain taught at.
Right, Skirtle descendant.
There you go. We've been talking about special ops community, and one of the and Gil sent me a very interesting article about the special operations community draining talent, and that this has been an issue for a while. So I wanted to have him on. How does the Marine Corps get on your horizon out of Bowdoin?
So I'm kind of a weird case. I went off. Got lucky, got a scholarship to grad school, went over to England for 4 years, studied history, and then came back. I was back home to get ankle surgery, started talking to an OSO, and joined the Marine Corps shortly after that.
Why the Marine Corps, though?
I had a friend when I was right after college. I was working in D.C., just interning at a think tank, and a friend of mine was kind of in the process, was about to go to OCS that fall. And so talking to him and a few other guys I'd run into, just got the sense that the Marine Corps was just a higher caliber, you know, person you're working with, just a good group of guys and you work with professionals and doing good stuff. So,
all right,
I kind of put that above the other services for me.
Okay, and you became an infantry officer?
Yeah.
All right, tell us in 2 minutes, tell us about your career.
So from there, went off to, this would have been, finished IOC early fall of 2010, went to 1st LAR, deployed with them, to Southern Helmand Commission District in 2011-12 as a platoon commander. Came back a little time
ago. Wait a minute. So we're battle buddies?
We might have crossed over by a minute, right? Weren't you there mid to late 11 or something?
Yeah, I got there in September. Oh, Third was down there. Is Third Rip with you guys when?
Third Rip with us. We ripped in with Second in November of 11, and then Third ripped in with us in 12 in May of 12.
Okay, so you got there when? September of 11?
No, it would have been, I think, November. I think we flew out on Halloween, actually.
Yeah, I would have missed you then. So you do that in 2010, then what?
Yep. 11-12, come back, a little bit of time, like 6 months in garrison as an XO, and then went to the Georgia liaison team, did about a year total between effectively kind of three deployments, went to Georgia for 3 months, a month in Germany doing their version of like an EMV,
right.
and then Afghan deployment after that as a combat advisor with them.
And if you're thinking, like, why do I know Gil? He and a friend of his wrote an article about advising and how we can do it better, and we had them on the program. And your co-author's name is?
Sam Long.
Sam Long. All right, so there you have it. So that's how you know him. So let's talk about and he sent me a couple of different things that I'll go ahead and I'll post when I post this interview. And one is an article out of the Marine Corps Gazette entitled "MARSOC: The Effect on the Rifle Squad," and that was published. I don't see a date on it, so I'm not sure. Any idea of the date when that was published?
I can bring it up here. It was I want to say he wrote that. She doesn't have a date on it.
Volume 95.
I think he wrote that in 14 or 15.
Okay, and then Master's of Military Studies entitled "Where Are the Infantry Sergeants?" and examination of the Marine Corps policies and processes that adversely affected the availability of infantry sergeants to serve as squad leaders in the operating forces. And this was done by Major Thomas Tennant, United States Marine Corps, and it was submitted on 17th March 2009. So I'll put both those that Gil forwarded. So talk to give me a thumbnail of the history behind MARSOC and this drain of sergeants, NCOs, and staff NCOs from our infantry battalions and the effect that that has had on the force as a whole, and then we'll talk about today. So give me a little bit of history.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple things up front. That article was January 2011, the Frick article, which I think is a good one for kind of laying out the problem a bit. I should say up front, you know, I'm not a MARSOC guy. I spent no time there. My debilitant before EAS and last year was with FAST, so very different, you know, side of the house, brand new Marines for the most part. So my knowledge is secondhand, coming from just keeping ear to the ground and having friends in that community and then just, you know, reading what's out there. But that being said, I think it's pretty clear that obviously between MARSOC recon and all the other opportunities to come to a junior NCO after his first enlistment, we absolutely cannibalize and you know, shortchange the infantry in terms of the caliber of the NCOs we retain and promote and the guys that are going to become our future squad leaders. So MARSOC came on the scene in 2006 and, you know, stood up from there and essentially kind of, you know, took a lot of force recon guys to get their initial, capability off the ground and then got to a, you know, a stable point, started recruiting from the Marine Corps large, I think. You know, someone that's been there to speak, you know, more specifically to that, but I think that's the basic narrative there. They took essentially the force recon companies and a little unit called the FMTU, the Foreign Military Training Unit, which was kind of like an expedient that had been stood up during the Iraq War to do combat advising. Basically pulled those guys in together to stand up their initial companies and battalions.
All right, but the total force in terms of special operations is what, 32, something like that, 3,200?
Yeah, I think they're about that now. When Frick's article was written, I think they were 2,600, and I think they're well over 3,000 now. That includes a healthy support component, too, I think. I don't think that's just the trigger pullers.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about it. So what was the effect, and is that simply the butcher bill that you have to pay up front, knowing that it's going to go down to a trickle after that? Talk to me about the institutional pain associated with creating Special Operations Command in the Marine Corps.
Well, I think you know, anecdotally, and someone's hopefully at some point will do the data, but anecdotally, you lose a tremendous percentage of your heavy hitters in infantry battalions to either MARSOC or recon. And the fact that you went from having, you know, the reconnaissance tax, if you want to look at it that way, or demand was always there, right? That kind of goes back to World War II and earlier. But, you know, that one at least you justified in terms of, hey, that unit is supports the MAGTAF, supports the GC, certainly, you know, of course, recon supports the MEF. So that piece you're doing necessary tasks to shape the battlefield for the MAGTAF as a whole, right? MARSOC's a different animal in that, you know, I got it, you give them to the nation and to those mission sets, but they're not supporting the MAGTAF. I mean, there may be, they're isolated examples, and sometimes they'll work side by side with conventional Marine units, but effectively you're shipping them off to the theater special operations commands. So that's the difference there. And then you're obviously at least doubling your demand from three reconnaissance battalions to now, you know, that's enduring capability plus the three special operations battalions, which are all going to be very top heavy in terms of manpower.
Talk to me about, give me your thoughts on, again, is this just the initial pain that you had to endure for, I don't know, 10 years? As MARSOC became a mature organization, or is this and then now feeding MARSOC is certainly costs us quality individuals, but it's manageable because just as a numbers thing, yeah, we will lose some and they will be good, but that has slowed down to a trickle. Your thoughts on that?
I think it's tough to say without, you know, you can, all you can really give is stories. One of the reasons being that we don't even track this stuff. I know for a fact that we don't track the caliber of the guys at EAS. You know, we lose X number of Marines. If you talk to people, and I've done this before in a different context, if you talk to someone in manpower about, you know, hey, do we have a retention problem? They'll say, no, we're doing great. We have more returning guys away. We're career designating officers. But then you ask the question, hey, what's the caliber of the guys we retain? Are we losing, are our best you know, third of corporals finishing the first enlistment. Are those guys, the majority of that top third, going to college, getting out, going off to do something else, you know, or are they staying in? And you're going to get a blank stare on that one, both on the officer and the enlisted side. So even if, you know, fit reps are an inexact instrument, even if we charted that, we'd have an idea for, or pros and cons for that matter, for younger Marines, what caliber guys we're losing. And as far as I can see, and again, I've asked this question with one of the captains from Manpower there a few years ago, and was told that that's, they don't need to keep track of those numbers. So that's part of the problem, right? But anecdotally, to me, it's...
I guess what would be the point of tracking that number? So we could know the pain?
Well, to see where you're, how you're actually doing in terms of retaining your best performers in your middle of the road guys, and what hopefully your lower tier guys are getting forced out in terms of not getting reenlisted or not getting career designated. But you should have an idea. I mean, I think corporate America will, any good corporation is going to keep track of the caliber of guys they can't retain.
All right, give me a solution.
Well, it seems to me, and this conversation was spurred by Gunnar Wade's interview. What was that, last week, right?
Right.
Certainly what we're doing now isn't working, right? I mean, he said 30% manning for infantry squad leader billets by TO, right?
Right.
I mean, I was surprised to hear it was that bad, but obviously... Like,
yeah, you know what? Honestly, I was too. I was 30% manning. It's like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? That's astounding.
And that's the billet, and I mean, I think that's the nub of it, right? I mean, you said, and I think everyone agrees on air, and I think almost anyone serving in infantry would agree that that's the most critical tactical billet is the squad leader, right?
Right. I would submit.
Not the platoon commander, not the platoon sergeant, not the higher up the chain, and certainly in the kind of fights we've been fighting for the last 10 years, even if it's a little dangerous to rely on that as your data, as your kind of fallback, right? But yeah, I mean, that billet's key, and half the time we're just throwing the next available guy into it. You know, he's probably a better PTer and has showed some leadership ability, but he may or may not have gone to the schools. He's almost, you know, the odds of him being a school-trained sergeant, as you said, are 30%. That's a pretty staggering number on the face of it, right?
Yes. Yeah, no. So, when you look at those numbers and you hear that, you're thinking, what the hell?
Yeah. It's just, you know, seeing that, and you see, I think a little bit in the last few years, you know, the Warriors kind of cloaked that a little bit, because I suspect, I don't know for sure, you could probably get a colonel or a general that could speak with more authority to this, but I suspect we kind of robbed Peter to pay Paul, and that units were, you know, NCOs were shuffled around a little bit. I know I had NCOs arriving late before my first Afghan deployment that had clearly showed up because they fit the right rank and MOS to be in a billet. So I think we did a little of that maybe cloaked that for units that were, you know, first in the stack deploying. But obviously for any kind of contingency or bigger war, that you have kind of a hollow force if you're having to constantly shuffle guys around to make ends meet, right?
Right. Right. But again, it's going to be a constant drain, yes? And no matter how you – the question is, do personnel policies – and assignment policies need to change to reflect the reality of that bill that MARSOC presents to the Marine Corps, yes?
Yeah, and I think it's not even as simple as MARSOC. MARSOC is just another straw on the camel's back. But you look at what we incentivize, right? I mean, you get what you incentivize personnel. So MARSOC, recon, and plenty of other jobs. You know, you got Marines, if you look around counter-intel guys, I'd say the majority of human counterintel guys I've worked with both overseas and in CONUS were former grunts, certainly a lot of them. There are all these other opportunities, and we probably should. I mean, I'd argue we probably should make that warrant officer pilots like the Army does, but regardless of that, you know, probably shouldn't go off on a tangent. But we've got all these other opportunities we incentivize and we throw it at, you know, high-caliber infantry NCOs, and we wonder why, when we, you know, a couple of years later when they should be back as sergeants, we've got nowhere near the guys and caliber guys we need. So I think that's really at the root of the problem in large part, is what we incentivize and what we push guys towards, right?
Well, you know, and again, compound that with the Marine Corps' discussion about does because of the technological complexity of running a squad, in terms of distributed operations, the increased technology that will be resident in the squad. You need a sergeant there, right? You need somebody with, because you don't, manpower can't support a staff sergeant being in that billet without the Marine Corps being turned upside down. And so you need a sergeant, and to hear that, you know, 30% manned is wow, you got to be kidding me. And then to think that, does that guy come with the right training? You know, because the job he's going to walk into, you know, is not the same job that Sergeant Stryker did, right? There's a few more bells and whistles that go with it, and as well as the leadership piece. So again, you throw the MARSOC thing in there, and it does become a curious little triangle of manpower, MARSOC, and then the fleet. And are we doing what we need to do to make sure that we have quality leaders at the sergeant level in the Fleet Marine Force? And I think at, you know, at first blush, you're wincing when you're looking at that triangle, going, I know who's going to pay the bill. Right, and it's not going to be MARSOC, and it's not going to be anybody else. It's going to be the fleet, and it makes you wince, because that's how people get hurt. You know, you look at, you know, why are there so many more accidents? Good question. Do you have based on your own, again, I'll give you do you have your own solution for all of this?
Yeah, let me continue on what you're saying for a second. I mean, that's ultimately right. I mean, Lance Corporals pay the bill, both in terms of, right, as you said, in terms of blood, in terms of not having the best possible decision makers and leaders. But even more, the thing I found particularly pernicious, and take this for what it's worth, you know, a guy that did 7 years and change and was lucky to deploy a few times. But the thing I found really pernicious about keeping inferior or keeping leaders that probably shouldn't have been the first guy in that position. And this goes up and down the chain, but let's put it at the squad level. The squad leaders there that should be mentoring and growing those Lance Corporals into their, you know, into guys that are going to repeat and exceed what they did, those guys aren't able to do that, right? I mean, the caliber of mentorship and what that does, you've got a feedback loop there, right?
Right.
So I think that's a huge piece of pie. And as you said, you've got, at least in theory, you've got bigger technological demands. You've got more UAVs and unmanned ground vehicles and everything else that they've been, the 3.5's been playing around with the last year or so.
Right.
You've got all that stuff coming into a squad, so the demand for and you've got for the probability, if not near certainty, of fighting a war among the people, even if it's a higher end, you know, war, you're probably fighting in populated areas. So you've got all that to juggle with, just like guys have been doing in Iraq and Afghanistan for a decade and a half. So, yeah, the cognitive demands on a squad leader are probably higher than they've ever been. That's probably not hyperbole. And at the same time, you know, we're not getting manpower commensurate with that. So,
did you just say the cognitive demand on the squad leaders is probably not hyperbole? Okay, do you know what program you're on, dude? Do I have to do I have to stick my foot up your ass to get you to speak English? You had like half the people just drive into ditches across the country listening to the program, man. This is all Marine Radio. This is the All Marine Radio, man. Dumb it down
for
us.
I'm sure everybody's keeping up.
So the bottom line is inconclusive relative, because of the data that we don't have, inconclusive in terms of the way ahead, but certainly something that needs to be examined.
Yeah, I mean, I think that 30% number, again, I was listening and just kind of stood up listening to that. I was thinking, like, that ought to be more. If we take the doctrine, what we preach seriously, right? You know, the idea that it's all about the Marine and not the equipment, and the kind of, I'm not a big John Boyd guy, but people that are, the idea you go, you know, people, ideas, and machines in that order. If we take that seriously, that 30% squad leader manning number should be far more concerning than F-18 availability rates and all the equipment crises in the wing, right? This should be a much bigger deal.
Well,
obviously it isn't.
I think it would depend who you're talking to, but I would agree. I would certainly agree with you. You can substitute another air platform. Okay, we both on that. You can substitute a drone, but what are you going to substitute on the ground? No robot's going to step in and become a squad leader. So, right. Yeah, as much as the aviation community might not like that, you know, from a consumer perspective of what happens on the ground, that's the truth. So, yeah, but when we talk hardware, people lose their minds because it's so expensive. So we'd lose that argument in a hurry, but it is the truth. Chris Julian's calling me from Al-Assad to give me an update on what that's like. Do you care if we continue this conversation at another time? Maybe get some more. I'd love to, because to me, it's one of the pressing problems of the Fleet Marine Force. Where are the sergeants? What is their level of training? And nobody has an answer for that.
Yeah, I would argue it's getting worse, but right. That's just one guy's experience.
I would, based on my discussions with both my sons, I would echo that. And again, it's not for lack of effort on the sergeant's part or school's parts, right? But there's the demand for sergeants has changed, and the requirements for sergeants have increased in terms of being proficient. And so something's got to happen. Gil Barndollar from Bowdoin College, my guest today. You can tell he's a smart guy. I think he's the first person to ever use hyperbole on All Marine Radio. So, first of all, congratulations on that deal. And as always, appreciate you chiming in and being part of the program. How's your transition going before I let you go?
Yeah, not bad. I had shoulder surgery about a month ago, so I've been kind of rehabbing with that. And then heading down to D.C. in about a week to move down there and start job hunting.
All right. What do you want to be?
I work in defense and foreign policy, whether that's on the Hill or a think tank or keeping an eye on you know, journalism, I put in there, that kind of stuff.
You're going to be part of the problem?
No, potentially.
Hopefully not. All right. Gil, first of all, thanks for the visit. We'll do this again in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, great talking to you.
All right, bud. Have a good one.
Have a good morning.
All right, there you have it. That is Gil Barndollar here on All Marine Radio.